1. All right, folks, welcome to lecture 29. We're in the midst of pipelining. You recall that pipelining is about performance improvement only. We already have figured out and done our dance that has a MIPS system that interprets MIPS and can actually run MIPS. This is only to make that faster. So there's some research which I was really curious to see because 3D is the big wave of the Consumer Electronics Show, CES. Some people are actually wondering, some people get headaches. Some folks get headaches after watching a 3D show. I actually watched a couple of bad 3D shows and got a headache. I never understood why some 3D gives me headaches and some not. And it turns out that this has been known for a while. That's not one of the key research results here. Marty Banks has describe why that is and has a system that, and by the way, Marty Banks is here at Berkeley, which is awesome, and he has a solution for it. So part of the system with eye strain is something called the vergence accommodation. Vergence is how much your eyes have to move to look at something in the middle. If I look at something in the middle, I have to verge to move to it, so how much your eyes have to kind of bend, right? Accommodation is, in kind of one eye, how I have to focus so I can squeeze my lens so that I can focus on something short, right? And normally, they're the same. Something's here, I have to, right in the middle, like a finger, I have to both verge at some amount and then accommodate at some amount, and I'm used to that. But 3D, I need to be accommodating to the screen because you're looking at the screen. So you're relaxing your lens and accommodating the screen, but verging is something virtually floating in front of you. You have to see that difference? And so because of that, you get what's called the vergence accommodation conflict. He has a lens that you wear. Here's a picture of a user in front of a series of lenses that, in theory, solves that problem so that you, I guess, have to accommodate where the 3D thing actually is. I'm going to guess that's what it does, so that you don't, in theory, have the eye strain. That's kind of cool. So that's part of the reason. So anybody, how many of you have eye strain sometimes when you go to 3D things? So some percent, look, some percentage, right? Maybe that's a quarter. So that's a useful thing. In review, we had seen a MIPS pipeline. The MIPS pipeline is 5 stages. Each stage does one thing. Pipelining is a big idea. Universally, processors are pipelined in industry, so it's important you know about it. One instruction per cycle. It's a multi-stage system. What makes this work really effectively is the stages do approximately the same amount of work, and that's critical because you are the pipeline frequency, the clock is a function of the slowest stage. So in the perfect case, they all do exactly the same amount of work, there's no loss. The worst case is where one guy takes a long time and everyone else has to wait for this longest stage, kind of like the weakest link problem. I stopped here and it looked like, oh, I have how many slides to go, but I actually looked at my slides. Turns out last year I stopped there also, so I should have just cut the slides out. So in fact, I was perfectly on time for the lecture. I didn't actually mean to get past that. I should have just cut those lecture slides out last time. So we're actually still on time, not having to rush this time, which is nice. There are 3 different hazards we're going to see. A hazard is something that makes a pipeline not be perfect. In a perfect world, the pipeline always works, and you're always processing exactly one instruction per cycle, and everything's in a perfect world. And there are 3 kinds of hazards that we classify. One is called, am I a little bit loud? I feel like I'm a little bit loud. Am I okay? It feels like I'm a little bit distorted. I'm too quiet. Okay, thank you. Thank you, Nick. I'll kick it up a notch. So the structural hazards, data hazards, and branching hazards, and we'll talk about branching or control hazards and data hazards, and we'll look at some examples like that. So the first structural hazard has to do with some kind of hardware can't support what you want to do with your pipeline. And some folks, some students after class pointed this out already, and so some people are already kind of aware of this. And the most obvious one is that, look, this is memory. How can I simultaneously be reading and writing from it in stage 4 and reading from it in stage 1 and have that happen at the same time, right? If a load is up here or store, then 4 instructions later, I'm going to be reading reading an instruction. Remember, the first stage was I look at the PC and read memory, and this guy was I read or write memory if it's a load or a store. How does that work? And that's the problem with that. Do we have a solution? I kind of alluded to it before. Two memories, right? So you cannot fully create 2 memories, but what you can do, and this is nice, and Bing's going to talk about this on Friday, and I'll finish up with this on Monday. we have something called caches, which is not a full memory, but is a local, small, fast copy. The most important part of that, the most important adjective there was fast. If it were small but slow, I don't care. But it has to be fast. The reason it's fast is memory is going to be one of the slowest pieces of this. And so it's got to be really, really fast. Hopefully, so fast that it can be done in one clock cycle. So, this is our smaller copy, and we're going to have two level one caches. You'll talk about level one either Friday or Monday, depending on where he gets to in the slides. So we're going to have a level one instruction cache and level one data cache, and that's a local copy of the main. There is just one memory. We know that. When you go to, you know, Fry's or Best Buy, you buy memory. So there's just one of them, but I have two smaller copies. And you could always ask, we'll learn about this on Friday, if you're buying a brand new machine, how big is the level one cache? And you should be able to find that out. You can ask that. You can ask an Apple hardware or PC hardware. You should always be able to find that information out. If they miss, if anything's not in the cache, you have to basically go get it and put it in the cache. And again, that's something you'll learn about on Friday, so I won't talk about there. But essentially, from this point of view, assume that it's both in the cache and it works, and that's how we solve that structural hazard. Okay? Questions? All right. Number two, you also may have noticed that there's two register guys, right? And blink. Well, what do we do there? In some sense, the whole memory, the way we fix the first structural hazard is even more complicated. To introduce a whole new caching system and copies and who's got the most recent version, that's complicated. That was a really complicated solution, but we're going to need it anyway for speed reasons. So we're going to see the caches are needed for speed, so we're glad caches exist. They basically solve two problems, one speed and two is the structural hazard. So we can now pipeline effectively. But this register is a problem. Anybody have a solution for it? Yeah. Another copy. Maybe that's another copy. The one fortune, we don't need that. The nice thing is we actually don't need that. And part of the key reason is registers are really fast. Remember the numbers I was giving you, 2 nanoseconds? It was always 1 nanosecond for the registers because they were really, really fast. Nick, what's the solution?
Just make sure that the top one is finished writing to register before it reads.
Exactly. Make sure this guy's finished writing before I read. Why is it that way versus the other way? Make sure. Why isn't it I read before I write? Exactly, because this instruction 3 might need the data that's been written to, so you need to have that. Now, when does the write happen? Remember the writes? Write happens at the end, but remember, that data was ready to be written at the beginning of this time. It's right at the end. It's the end of some cycle. It's the end of this cycle is that memory or the ALU is finished getting its data, right? So it's ready right here, sitting there. So what do you think the write happens? Right after that. Registers are fast. So that happens right after that. Now, wouldn't it be great if registers were asynchronous? So whenever that happened to stabilize, that write happens really fast, right? Much faster than a read happens. Like, boom, it happens. Or not necessarily faster than a read, but fast enough that I can do both a write and a read at the same clock cycle. So the write happens, blink, can I do this same time? And that's the question. And the answer is, I'm telling you what this slide says, which is that register files are really fast. They're so small. We talked about 32 by 32. It's only 1024 bits. Really fast. Writes happen during the first, we'll call it half. We'll just give them a whole half to do the write, the reality. But it might even do it much faster than the first half. And I read during the second half. But at the end of the time, I have my valid data from there at the end. So the summary is, I can perform a read and write at the same time, and so I'm done. And I even draw the picture. I had the pictures here. They had kind of a dark area and the light area, and that was asked to indicate that the write happens right here, and the read happens right there. So it actually works out perfectly. Yes, question? Correct. The write should happen before the read, and in fact it does. The write happens right after the clock period, blink, and then the read happens any time after that. It'll just propagate it the way through and it works out. Yes, question? Correct. For this to work, you kind of have to be able to write and read in the same clock cycle, and we have no trouble with that. The register is almost never the guy who's the bottleneck. It's usually the memory system or something else. Registers are really, really fast in general. Okay? Yes, they're right on the chip, which is nice. Okay, you write something in instruction 2, but you need an instruction 3? That's great. Save that for the data hazard. It's about a data hazard. OK? Okay, so save that question for about four slides from now. Question? Are registers faster than cash? Typically they are. The reason they're faster than cash is they are a different technology. They are on raw silicon. Caches are SRAM, which is a different kind of memory. It's a different kind of process. But raw silicon on the CPU die, that real estate is like Boardwalk and Park Place combined. I mean, it is ridiculously expensive to have that. So you don't have a lot of it. So we'll have a little bit for registers, so they're impossibly fast. And that's how we're going to use, you know, everything is a register operation. Every single operation is about registers. So these have got to be as fast as possible. But caches, we can afford to be a little bit, we don't put them on the chip. L1 caches are not often on. Sometimes they're on chip, I guess. Yeah, nowadays L1 and 2 are on chip, but not. Say it again. Oh, interesting. Interesting. All right. So Scott's the local expert. Scott's a PhD grad student in the architecture, so I always refer to Scott. And so a bit of registers is bigger than a bit of SRAM. So they kind of pack them tighter and therefore are slower in the process, I guess, for SRAM. Right. They're slower but smaller. So you get more of them. You've done something special to make them big and fast, I guess. And the technology of that is really fun, and I'm sure 152 would teach that. 141, E141 teaches that. Good set. So go on the other side of Hearst. Love it. Okay, so we're done with structural hazards. Two structural hazards. You saw that there were two R's lined up and two, remember, lined up, solved. Okay, let's go to the branching, and branching is a lot harder. We have 9 slides for branching, so let's talk about that. And in fact, it's going to involve an entire language redesign. So this is going to be a big deal, so let's go slowly. So branching means you have a branch equal. You make a test, and you either take the branch or not, which means your PC changes. Well, why is that a problem? Where does the compare happen for the branch? ALU stage. So you're going to make a decision of what's the next instruction to fetch at the end of that ALU stage. Well, which means you're going to affect instruction 3. So what do you do if you have instruction 1, instruction 2 already in the pipeline? Well, how about this? If you were not supposed to take the branch, you're okay. Yay. What if you were supposed to take the pipeline? What if you were supposed to take the branch? Then you've got instruction 1 and 2 already in the system. What do you think we do? Yeah. Exactly. That's great. That's a really good solution. The only guy who's going to affect anything, remember, we always know that every piece of these 5 stages are always doing something. If they're asynchronous, they're always reading or something. But when does a change happen? Here, when I write to memory if I do, or here when I write to registers if I do. Or maybe here if I'm going to take another branch or something if I do. All that stuff, right? So all the things that might make a change, I just tell control, don't make that change. That's easy to do. Do I know about it in time? Sure. I don't know it by this time or this time, but by here, by the end of the ALU, I know that, and I haven't had to make a write yet. So, in fact, I can make a change so that instruction 1, instruction 2 are kind of, ineffective. They don't make a change, right? Well, it's still a problem because, in a way, what it means is two instructions after will always be fetched. And now I've kind of wasted 2 things. You know, if you think about making a lot of changes, a lot of ifs, let's say a really tight for loop, you're always kind of wasting 2 instructions. So you're it's like one branch took you 3 instructions because you kind of wasted 2, right? So here's the catch, right? If we don't take the branch, don't waste any time and keep executing normally. We said that. We already have a system that handles that, right? But if we do, we certainly don't want to execute in those, and that we have a solution for that, which is don't do the writes. But the problem is, we'd have to kind of have, either have no-op operations that don't do anything, but nevertheless, whether you put a no-op or you don't do anything, whether you keep them in there and don't do it anyway, the problem is you still are taking 3 clock cycles for a branch, and you don't want that, right? So you don't like that. So, how about this? Yes, Nima.
Could you just get the 3 wires that come from the memory, and then when you read the instructions from the memory, just get those wires?
I think what you're saying is what's on the slide. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but you were suggesting find out earlier. Like, look out as soon as you can. Before ALU stage. And the earliest you know about whether those two registers are equal is when you've read those registers out. And that happens at the end of stage two. So why wait to the end of stage three to know this compare? Insert a special compare guy, a little bit more silicon, right? In a way, it's like moving away from using our ALU for our compare with the whole nice subtract. Remember we did that? Subtract into zero, the flag that comes back to control. What if you had this additional comparator that was now at the end of the stage two, right after the registered block, and you could make decisions then? You would save one instruction, right? We agree with that? That's awesome. So we now have the branch comparator move to the decode stage, or stage two. So we have effectively made a change. We've added some silicon. That's a great trade-off to save one instruction per branch. We love that. Hold on, let me finish the thought. So then we're still stuck. We still have instruction one, which gets thrown away. And we don't like that. We really don't like that. You have a question? Let's stop now. Yeah. I guess the question is, why do we have to do this? We want to make sure our pipelined result is exactly the same as the serial result, single cycle CPU. So in the single cycle CPU, we do not do anything with instruction one. So we have to at least nullify its change. And what we're saying now is when we pipeline it, we're still wasting an instruction. We'd like to not be as wasteful. But the critical thing that you brought up was we better have the same, if I'm reading this, and instruction one looks like it's going to make a change. In the single cycle CPU, we certainly don't even get there. We wait till this finishes, decide it's a branch, and we jump around this. So if we jump around this, then instruction two is where we had branched to. This is the new guy that gets loaded, that gets, you know, the PC moves to that position. This, the one after that branch in the code, should never be run. But in fact, it would be run if we didn't add this fix to make it nullified, to kind of chop it off as its legs. It's still wasteful, is the point of this. And so let's see if we can make it not wasteful. So here is the branch, and the right thing is to kind of insert this no-op. And this, when I say insert this no-op, it is, you almost have to, aside from the fact that you could have hardware that's smart in the control side, you could also insert a no-op in the compile phase, where you actually add an extra NOP, all zeros. Remember, no-op is an all zeros instruction, which I think says shift left logical from 0 to 0 by 0. That's what all zeros reads. So you would actually add this to your code. Your code bloats by one instruction before the link phase where it calculates the sizes of where those things are, and it would just work out nicely. So inserting an op is there. But you still, as I said, have two instructions per second. We don't want that. So how do we get around that? Well, let me tell you a story about an engineer, physicist, and mathematician asked to build a fence around sheep. So let me see if I get this right. The engineer is asked to build a fence around some sheep, and the engineer figures out the minimum amount of fencing uses a circle, so uses the circle and encloses some amount of sheep and calls themselves done. The physicist, help me with this one, I'm blanking. If you ever tell a joke, remember the joke before you actually get up on stage. So the physicist, maybe somebody Googles this, the physicist goes and estimates some number of sheep. The point is not the physicist. The point is he's just the second guy in the joke. Physicist does something and ha-ha about physicists. But the point of the joke, well done. Let's go back a year and watch my joke last time. The mathematician draws a fence around himself, considers himself to be outside, and he's done. That's very beautiful, right? So kind of neat, if you think about it, actually, right? You know, the fence borders two things, and that's what it's done. Okay, so if somebody can tell me what the physicist does, that would be funny before the end of the lecture. That would be funny. Okay, so what if we changed the definition of what a branch is? Just like the mathematician did. What if you actually changed the definition of what the branch is to make pipelining faster? Whoa. It's a kind of a cheater way to do it, but let's do it. Ready? A branch now always executes the instruction after it before it does the branch. The instruction after it is in a slot. Like there's like the branch, and then there's like this slot of some extra time, and then you take the branch. We're going to call that the branch delay slot, because the branch doesn't happen immediately. The branch happens kind of one instruction late. It's like somebody who you tell a joke to, and just now they're laughing at the mathematician joke I told about a minute ago. That's like, it's like this. It's like the branch, and then you wait a little time, and then they laugh. Okay? Or branch, then you run one more instruction, and then you actually take the branch. If you change the definition of branches, you have no delay anymore. There's zero delays. You now have perfect pipelining, and if you can somehow guarantee that instruction in the branch delay slot is correct, meaning isn't kind of a based on that and you're going to do it anyway, then you're fine. That means you've filled it with an instruction that's valid. So, how about this? We now have to distinguish. Remember before we were doing with MIPS and I just said MIPS. And then when we learned about MAL versus TAL, I had to then tell you, I say write MIPS, and you come back to me, what kind of MIPS do you want? MAL MIPS or TAL MIPS, right? It's like jump, you say how high. Now I say write MIPS, you say, well, do you want MAL versus TAL? There's now an additional question you have to ask me. I say write some MIPS, and you need to say to me, just like the mathematician just redefined what outside is, you say, do you mean delayed branch MIPS or non-delayed branch MIPS? Up to now, you've been doing which one? Non-delayed branch MIPS, right? Hit a branch and you immediately go away. But you can also, in your mind, read delayed branch MIPS, right? It's easy to read, right? Branch, do the next guy, and then you go or not. Right? So that's important. We've now changed the language and changed the definition of what MIPS is. So here's the key thing. As you're compiling things down, you're compiling things down now for delayed branch or non-delayed branch now. Which means you better say, if you're a compiler, that you better have a flag, which is the assembler that you're outputting, delayed branch or non-delayed branch, MIPS. Okay? Because you need to tell you, if I'm putting out, spitting out adds and loads and branches, should I be assuming you're reading that, if you were kind of a hand assembling or thinking about actually running it past an assembler, are you interpreting the guy after the branch to be run or not run? That's the important thing. So you need to be able to tell me very explicitly, is this branch delayed or not branch delayed, or is it called non-delayed branch or branch delayed MIPS? If it is branch delayed MIPS, in the worst case, you put a no-op in the gap, and you're back to the case where branches take two slots, because you don't do anything that one spare slot. In the best case, you fill it with something that could actually be usable. And if you can, that's the best case, no time is wasted, and you can pipeline, and you have no branch, you have no control hazard. Love it, right? So, let's look at it. Non-delayed branch world, here's my guy. If I'm reading this as non-delayed branch MIPS code, and I do take this branch, this XOR is never seen. Okay? If I think of now the delayed branch mode, what can I do in terms of maybe reordering some instructions so that I'll put something and fill, if I said, hey, Dan, this is now going to be treated as delayed branch. Well, I better insert a no-op so the XOR doesn't get run. Right? We agree XOR should not get run. I cannot run the same code and just change it from non-delayed branch to delayed branch because now the XOR gets run if it's delayed branch. So what do I do? What can you look at anything that I can do that can maybe stuff in the branch delay side? Yeah. I can put the or the add in there. Well, I don't know about the add. Because the add's a one and it's looking at one. But I can definitely look at the or. So, on the delayed model, I take the or, I move it down, I swap it around. All I've done is swap things, so my code size hasn't bloated. The problem with no-op is, A, I'm guaranteeing paying myself of two instructions per branch. Guaranteed. Right? Whether I take the branch or not, I wasted a time. The no-op was a wasted time. That's A. Because I know that in a delayed branch world, I got to hit that guy anyway, so I'm always wasting one cycle doing nothing. That's annoying to me, slower code, and my code is bloated. I had to add another line, which means as you have a lot of them, your code starts to bloat. All of a sudden, you're downloading this thing, and it's much bigger. My branch delayed says BEQ, you do the OR, you jump. The reason this is valid is because OR doesn't affect anything the branch is based on. And OR doesn't affect anything it sets up, the one and the $4, so that's okay. Okay? So, is it hard or is it easy to fill a branch delay slot? Well, it kind of depends. And compilers have a variable rate, but compilers, as a compiler now, this is now why you might have more appreciation for how hard 164 is going to be. Honestly, you are now have to make a decision. Here's some C, hopefully you're not compiling C, maybe you're compiling a smaller language like maybe Scheme or something nice like that. But if you're compiling to a machine that, right, this is where the compiler author needs to know what kind of machine it is. This is the first time, by the way, that we have peaked below and changed what MIPS is so that my ISA is different because MIPS is no longer what MIPS is, right? So because of our hardware, we have affected our software. We've affected the language of what ISA is by redefining what MIPS is. So that's a really important thing, but the win we get is crazy. So that's why we've actually made a new this. So that's important and fortunate that you have this kind of cross-boundary thing where you have to, at the higher level software level, need to know what's below you to compile to. But we can do it about, I think the numbers are about half the time. That's kind of the sense that I've got from other folks who do this a lot. I don't do this a lot, but they say it's about half the time that we get. Eric. Ah, excellent question. If you have a non-CPU pipeline, you might have a much longer pipeline. And what you're going to see a movie at the end where we call about the branch tax. Because if you have a really long pipeline, but the branch is done late, then you might have a lot of instructions that you've already loaded in that you have to throw away and you're wasting. So we happen to only lose one by moving the comparator up and all that. But if you have a much longer pipeline but actually read those registers and do the query check late, then that's called the branch tax is a lot higher. The tax is like the extra wasted instructions. Here is only one instruction, but in theory, a longer pipeline might have more penalty. Yes, question.
Does anybody actually ship non-delayed branch
MIPS
processors, or is it just something that we're
using? I think for the most part, every MIPS hardware is a pipeline system. So if it's a pipeline system, you're always doing delayed branch MIPS. By the way, MIPS is not very popular, as you know, so it's not like people are doing that. But you just saw the earlier slide that there are now supercomputers based on MIPS. So in theory, that's still there. And my understanding is, I can't promise, but my understanding is that it's all pipeline. The whole world is pipeline, is the idea. Yes, because you get 5 times improvement or longer if you have more stages. Yes, Oren.
In the case of a non-delayed branch, do you think
Say it again?
In the case of a
non-delayed
branch, does the BEQ always take
3 clock cycles? Does the BEQ take 3 clock cycles? Why is it 3? I see 1 BEQ, then you do this effort, and then you... On the non-delayed branch... If this is non-delayed branch, you have to insert, but you're running it on a MIPS that is interpreting it as delayed branch, you have to have inserted a thing. There's no other way to do it. You have to have inserted a no-op, and you have to take 2 clock cycles. 2 clock cycles, not 3. Okay? So I can't, as I said, you can't run non-delayed branch code on delayed branch hardware. So you have to have thrown in a no-op to make it work. Okay, well, maybe we'll come after. I'll have time. Yes, question in the corner.
Do people ever actually write delayed branch MIPS, or do they let the assembler take
care of it? The question is, do people ever write delayed branch, or let the assembler, it's the compiler that's generating code for you. So the compiler is the guy generating your MIPS for you. And people do hand author it. I mean, there are some people who hand author assembler even today. For the most part, 99.99% of people let the compiler do the work for you, but people still hand author it. As you guys could do yourself. You could, go into a text file, type some stuff out, and run it from there. There's no reason that you can't do that. Okay. So, data hazards. That was it. Structural hazards, one, done. Control hazards, done. Right? Data hazards. This is a little bit more complicated. Ready? Go. But only 2 slides, but it gets worse. Considering the following sequence of instructions. Add sub and or XOR, nothing weird, no branches, no loads, easy, right? Yeah. T0 got written, but it's needed immediately. So red is bad in the arrows, and so we actually don't have a proper value until the XOR. That's not very good. And this happens all the time, right? You know, if you... look back to your code, right? Z equals X plus Y, and the next line you use Z, right? That's very easy. That's very common. And guess what? This is what you have in the sense of that. Do you agree that this is okay? That this register is okay? This green line is okay? So we agree with the green? How about this red line? Well, what do you think? Didn't we cover that? Didn't we cover that already? Yeah. We covered that already. In that the right actually happens here. Right? So we're good there. So we're fine. Oh, thank you. Yay! You guys don't have handouts, right? Oh, what happened with the thing? Oh, my gosh! Lee, thank you so much. Yay! Lee is awesome! Okay. Let's get these out, and I think Long owes Lee a cookie, or at least. Okay, thank you so much. All right. You were remarkably quiet. That's interesting. You need to tell me these things so I can... Dan, the projector's off. Oh, I didn't know. Tell me these things, that, you know, that kind of stuff. Right? Sometimes I don't turn my back or something. Dan, the solution to the peer structure question is in the slides. Thank you. That kind of thing. Tell me those things. It's important to know these things. Dan, you've handed out the solutions to the final exam, not the final exam. Good to know, right? Good information to know. Maybe we're doing a Jeopardy. What is a pipeline question, you know, based on the answers? Okay. So, we have a solution. The solution is we see if we can forward the information where it's needed. What does forwarding mean? Forwarding means we add extra wires and an extra mux for every forwarding line here that's a different pattern that sends, rather than, you know, that as an example, this ALU is a straight line from that register in all the drawings we've had. Well, now, the ALU sometimes gets its data from itself, right? That's the output of the ALU fed into the line one of the ALU, right? Well, why line one? Why not also, line two is going, hey, what about me over here? So you need also to have a line to line two. Well, line two already has a mux waiting for what? Determining between the immediate or bus B. So that has to then extend to be a third option. You with me there? So that line, which is the output of the ALU back to the inputs, is another line that we need to have. But it's not just there. It actually is a little bit harder. Because obviously this line doesn't go straight into there. It goes through not a mux, but a register as well to hold the value. Right, you can't just go straight in. You have to hold the value so it's clocked, so it's waiting there stable while the whole next clock cycle has it. Right, you can't just go from the ALU to the ALU and hope it's going to be stable. That's a timing thing. That won't ever work. It's a race condition. That won't ever work. You have to send this through a register to clock it through to hold it there. Every dotted line has to register. That's how you clock things through there. But look, this guy also goes to the future. It's already the future here, right? The future here. But what's this future? Uh-oh. What does that mean? What does that second green line say on slide 20? Hold it not just for one clock cycle, but two. How do we do that? Two registers. Uh-oh. Wait, you just told me I had to have a mux, which is whether it's bus A or ALU output, delayed by one. Now it's bus A, ALU delayed by one, ALU delayed by two. Yeah. Okay. Hey, remember I said earlier that control is harder than data path? Data path is easy. I just add another mux. It's control that has to figure out when to send that guy and to remember the pattern of all those things. Yeah. Are you starting to believe me now why control is harder? Good. If you and a partner are doing control data path, you do the data path. Okay. So, remember this line, we cover that's in the structural hazard, so that green line is okay, the last green line is okay, we're done. But now, remember, the right AL, you guys going, hey, what about me over here? So you got the same one or two delay for that ALU, plus the sign extension or zero extension guy. Now we're choosing between among four guys, bus B, sign or zero extension, one ALU delay or two ALU delays. Thank you very much, Stan. We believe you now. Control is harder than data path. Okay? Question? Correct. This is they get turned on. That's the control part. If there's a T0 there and it's read by there, then you have to kind of figure out which guy to turn on so that the T0 gets to the right place. That's the whole table of making sure this all works, right? Very complicated. Thankfully, control is just combinational logic and some state, so it's not that bad, but it's a big combinational logic table to make sure you cover all the cases, right? That's kind of cool. So forwarding. Now is the problem. Remember how we had to redefine MIPS? Yeah. So now I need to know whether my system has forwarding or not. Oh, man. If I tell you that I ran out of money and couldn't afford to put a machine that has forwarding, what do you do as the compiler as you're spitting out things that may have data hazards with no forwarding?
No ops.
No ops. So you now need to know another flag from the compiler. Are you, not forget about the delayed branch, non-delayed branch, as another feature, which is, are you forwarding or not? Now, technically, there's all the forwarding, or maybe just that one or this one. We either, at this point, to make it simple, say forwarding, which is all the wires that you need to make these things not be problems, or no forwarding, which means none of these wires are there, which means all the hazards you need to know about, which means you need to no op or stall for all those things. Okay? Yes. Okay, so no forwarding for the first guy. The earliest I know about it is this. No forwarding. It's not forwarded from here or from there. It's there, so I probably could wait till I read it there. So I probably have two no ops in there, so that this reading would happen at the same time. Because that we know it already works in the structural hazard part. So that's two no ops I need between the first and the second is the idea. Okay, and the rest of it works, I believe. Okay, so it's basically these two guys. Here's the two forwarding. The only two forwarding lines are these two arrows. That's not forwarding. That's the register guy. So that's just two. Yes, question?
Is the forwarding line connected to both the wire?
Yes, there's four forwarding lines. Whether it goes through one delay, two delay to the A wire, one delay, delay to the B wire or the LU. Yep, good question. Yes, Jordan? How do the engineers not go insane? Well, you have computers that figure out where the forwarding lines need to be, essentially, right? You let computers help you with these hard problems of that, rather than let somebody have a big whiteboard and do that. You let the computer figure out as much as you can. Same technique is used, exactly that. I mean, you have things calculated either earlier. This is a generic pipeline. This is even a simple pipeline. It's five stages. You have larger things. It's much more complicated to talk about the real thing. This is, by the way, one of the reasons we don't talk about ADX86 because it's just so complex because it's the real system. This is much more pedagogic and simple, and it's still in use. You know, printers, PS2s are still MIPS and supercomputers. All right, let's keep it going. All right, 10 minutes to talk about something more complicated. So now we have two problems, right? I told you about a new redefinition of MIPS, branch delayed or non-branch delayed MIPS. I talked about whether the hardware has forwarding or not and knowing where the no ops must be to fix that. The last one is a load. Oh, man. Remember red arrows are bad? Yeah, red arrow. So what do? We know about it there, but we need it there. Even if we have forwarding, we can't deal with that. There's no way, even with all the forwarding lines we have in there, that we can get the data from memory at the end of this stage, or the fourth stage, and get it to the ALU that needed it at the beginning of the fourth stage to do its job. There's no way. No way. Ah, what do you think? What do you think? What do we do in the MIPS world, in the branch world? Let's change the definition. Oh, I like it. Let's change the definition. Before it was called the branch delay slot, what do we call this one? Load delay slot. Ladies and gentlemen, I welcome the load delay slot. Now, here's the catch. To get it more complicated, loads are so common, this load and needing it, that the hardware actually can know about it. The hardware knows there's a load, and knows that the next guy needs it. It knows it right here, right? At the end of this instruction fetch, actually at the end of this register phase, I know what register you needed, and I knew that what I had from before. So at the end of this phase, I know that I'm going to be in trouble, right? At the end of stage two of the second guy. So if the hardware has something called interlock, what's the etymology of interlock? Like, so it doesn't lock? I mean, I would call it loads not breaking feature. Oh, interlock. If it has something called interlock, what it will do is it will stall the pipeline, meaning it will wait one cycle automatically, not at the level of the compiler inserting a no-op, but actually allowing code in this. This is the code that's in the executable. This is the code that will have the wrong value if interlock is not turned on. If I just run this in a five-stage pipeline, that T0, my friend, is the old T0, not the new T0. And it only works if T0 doesn't change in that load. Right? I mean, in the rare case, when I do this load and T0 doesn't change, I'm getting the same value. But 99% of the time, this is going to be the old bad value. Or 1 over 4 Gibby times, this is going to be, in probability-wise, the wrong value. So that is a problem. Which means, in the olden days, if I knew I was running on this machine, a five-stage pipeline machine, I would have had to, in the branch world, insert something into that, otherwise the wrong thing would happen, right? But if I happen to have smart hardware called interlock, I don't worry about it. I actually have load hazards in the code, but I know my system is going to work because it'll just work. It'll stall it when it needs to, which is like what you want, right? Don't you want something smart? Right, you write bad HTML, but what? The browser just does it right. You know, it just works. You know how it is? You know, you push the gas and the brake at the same time on a Prius, and it just works kind of thing. There's some joke in there. I don't know where that is. But anyway, the point is, you want it just to work, right? So interlocks in there, it just works. It just works. It stalls when it needs to. The data comes around, and it's available in the nice green. The red arrow turns to a green arrow, and it's ready. Okay? That's great. Now, if the hardware does not have interlock, but you have produced code that does not have something in there, you are going to get an error. 1 out of 4 billion, 4 billion minus 1 over 4 billion, which is almost 1, with almost certainty, that's going to be the old value, and that's bad. Okay? So, long story short, there's two worlds. The fact that I have interlock now means that at the compiler level, if the hardware doesn't have interlock, I need to insert a no-op. Right? Or, even better, I can put something in the load delay slot doesn't affect the order. I can reorder in some cool way to stuff something in my load delay slot, so it doesn't matter. So I would never, in the worst case, have to ever stall, even if I had interlock turned on, right? If I have no interlock turned on and nothing in the load delay slot, meaning I have this code, then that's the wrong answer. So I never want to have that. I can never have bad code. So I either have to have interlock turned on, but in that worst case, I wait. I still have that penalty of waiting a cycle. I don't want to have any penalty like that. And you rewrite memory a lot. I don't know if you look at your code. You rewrite memory a lot. So you don't want to have all these delays where your code is effectively half the speed because you're waiting for this one no-op in there. Or with interlock, you're waiting for the interlock to finish. So, same as the branch delay slot. You try to fill it when you can. If you can fill it, great. If you can't, you put a no-op in there. Okay? And that will work on both interlock and non-interlock there. So there's your no-op. That'll do the same exact same thing so that the red light works. Okay? Good. Question? Going back two slides. I want to make sure I have enough time for two slides. Go quick. No other forward memory. I think there actually needs to be a forwarding wire from memory to ALU. Yes. That is a forwarding wire that is not there if I turn forwarding off. Okay? Excellent point. Thank you for that. Great question to ask. Good. Okay. Here we go. Pipelining. And then I want to ask you a question about peer instruction because I'm giving you a lecture. I'm giving a lecture on that on the clickers. So I want to ask a question about the clickers. Ready? Thanks to pipelining, I reduced the time it took me to wash my one shirt, and longer pipelines are always a win because less work per stage and a faster clock. Ready? Go. I vote 200 because I want to make sure I have a question. I want to ask real data that I will use in my talk about clickers. So as soon as this gets to 200, I'll stop. 200, quick. Click in there, everybody. I also have time to collect the clickers as well. All right. Well, we'll stop now. And, wow. A is correct, so that actually doesn't require much discussion. That was probably too easy a question. This is like a really easy question. It's not reduced the time. What have you done? Why is the A false? Throughput versus latency, right? Latency is the same. Throughput is increased, so you haven't changed your latency. How about this guy? By the way, A is often more. Remember we looked at actually a single cycle CPU, if you just did them as fast as you can, you do it in like 8 nanoseconds, but if 2 nanoseconds is the minimum clock time, it's 10 nanoseconds. So in fact, even a load is slower in pipelining, right? How about this guy, always a win? No, why? Longer pipelines have branch taxes. That's the other thing. You have this. Lots of reasons why you can't just continue to maximize that. Any answer in general? Any answer that says always, not all, is probably not correct. Very few things are alwayses. Okay, I want to ask a quick question. Shh, before you go. Can I have people start to migrate to the front who want to give us your clickers? And I'll have people over here collecting them. I need to borrow, you saw my email, I hope. If you need to borrow some clickers, hope you have your names in the back. I have a question on the fly really quick. Here we go. Clickers, worth it if they're free. If free. So aside from, I know the cost is a big factor. I want to factor out the cost. If I were to hand you clickers, are they worth the time in lecture for what they give you back? That's what I want to get to this, okay? So A, strongly agree. B, mildly agree. C, neutral. D, mildly disagree. E, strongly disagree. Clickers worth it as a statement. Clickers worth it if free. Okay? In terms of what they give to lecture and what they give for you in terms of feedback. By the way, I had this new policy. I just thought of it today. I want to have you email questions to me that I will put as questions for the class. So if you said, you know, Dan, I want to know whether I feel like I'm lost in, say, pipelining. I would like to know if I'm the only one. So you email a set of questions, and I will pick for the best questions and then ask that of the class so that will be something that you can ask the class anonymously. Isn't that kind of cool? So that's kind of neat. So I've instituted that this week. Send me some questions you want. Subject 61C, question on the fly, though. Put that in your subject so I can search for my mail. Ready? Go. Okay. Clickers worth it or free? Okay. All right. Good data. Good data. Excellent. 3, 2, 1, stop. All right. Excellent. Thanks, folks. Those of you who want to give me clickers, come to the front. Make sure your name's on it, and we'll just collect them all up. And I'll return them on Monday. Thanks, folks.